why can't we create this bundle that is a mommy-baby bundle so that we can then innovate and get processes in place to take care of these moms that will have generational benefits? And so there's things like that, which we just can't create a sustainable model. Beyond the passion and the mission is math. It's not all that complicated, meaning you've got to be able to deliver a service that gets to an outcome someone cares about, and you have to be able to get paid slightly more than what you deliver it for.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. I've always been a fan of health policy and public health leaders making a shift to entrepreneurship. They bring on-the-ground experience and understanding of how policy shapes markets and systems thinking that is often missing in founders. I'm thinking about Farzad Mostashari, founder of Aledade, and Rebecca Gee, founder of Nest. And that's not at all surprising to today's guest, Nancy Brown, one of the most successful and savvy healthcare investors in the country. In this conversation from Aspen Ideas Health, she points out that not only do policy leaders make great founders, their businesses are often grounded in public health and policy experiments. Nest was inspired by the Nurse Family Partnership and Aledade by the work Farzad and Tom Frieden did in New York City. So if public health is the source of the ideas and the evidence, how can we bring more of these innovations to scale through businesses? Just a note before you listen, Nancy and I recorded in late June before HR 1 was passed. So at the time of this recording, big Medicaid cuts were a threat, but not yet a reality. And now, please welcome Nancy Brown to The Other 80. Nancy, thank you so much for coming on the show in this beautiful location in Aspen. Can't beat it.
You cannot beat it. Thank you for having me.
We were offline telling amazing stories about Todd Park and our mutual adoration of this incredible guy. What's a story you would tell for Attribution? One of your favorite stories about Todd?
For Attribution, yes.
For Attribution.
So the context, just for listeners, is that I worked with Todd at Athena Health. Even today, people don't understand how special Athena Health is. It's moved on to new ownership, but the whole concept was to be able to go in to provider offices, let them do their jobs of being able to see patients and be spectacular at clinical care and take all the rest of it sort of out of their way, and to apply, as Todd would say, maniacally focused. Did he use that word a few times when you worked together? Maniacally focus on the workflows and try to figure out exactly what was the most optimal workflow so that processes were successful. So Todd was just relentless in this pursuit, you know, and so every time we had our staff meeting, you sort of never knew, you know, what he was going to bring up. He just sees things in ways that are very different in the best possible way. 10 people are going to assess something. Most of the time, it'll be 9.5 will have the same opinion. If Todd's in that group, he'll have a completely different point of view.
And we were talking about how he just sees future possibilities in other humans in ways that I think often we don't even see for ourselves. And you sort of wonder, like, how are you going to actually make it to this vision that he just described for you?
Yes. It wasn't just that I was trying to, you know, fundamentally transform clinical care. You know, it was sent from the gods to fundamentally change the world, you know. So this is what he believed, you know, and he acted every day like every minute counted towards that goal. So it was really inspiring.
I was looking at Oak's investment philosophy, the webpage. I so appreciate that you have that.
Thank you for looking at that.
And I think the crux of it at the very top was the belief that great businesses can shape and change systems.
Yes.
And whether from investments you've made or others, how would you say that investments in visionary health companies have change the system? And I would just say, caveat, I think for many of us, when we experience healthcare, we still experience a lot of brokenness. What are some places where that you would point to say, this has really shifted?
You can see the tears running down my face of how many years I've been in this business and how far I think we've gotten, which unfortunately is not as far as I would like. But yeah, so let me bring us back up a level and tell you, you know, what we do and sort of, and I explain this a lot at Aspen Ideas at Aspen Health, because there's a lot of people here with a lot of great ideas. And my addition to that is, how do you turn them into sustainable businesses? So if you want to achieve the ability to support caregivers, family caregivers, or to have empathy built into caregivers, you know, how do you actually create that as a business so that you don't have to go, you know, dialing for dollars each time? So at Oak, we're all about cost and quality. And the genesis of that for me was, I grew up professionally in a staff model HMO in Boston, which is like Kaiser. We were the payer and the provider. And that sort of gave us an ability to control spend, to decide where money should be spent, and to actually deliver the care and control the care. And that then led us to really understand innovation around healthcare, like what should we be doing, and really, really hard questions about, you know, do you go for experimental treatments or do you make sure everyone's vaccinated? There's only so much money, and those weren't real decisions, but just as, you know, mm-hmm. just to make a case. And so we studied during the day. I ran clinics, big multi-specialty clinics, and at night, literally, along with Don Berwick, back when he was a pediatrician, just starting quality management initiatives at Harvard Community, where we were, we would study processes like hip replacements. It was a 6-day length of stay. And, you know, when we began to study these processes, and I'm not a clinician, but I've always worked with them, we were using methodologies used by the car companies to reduce defects. And this wasn't about billing people. This was about the actual care. And what we discovered in all of these instances of studying these is that there was a bunch of artifact left in these processes. Like the second day after care, way back when I did this, the orthopedic surgeon said, we're good. Like, I'm like, well, what's going on for the other 4 days? Well, they're getting people ready to be transitioned, and no one's talked to them about, like, do you have stairs? Do you have someone at home? Is there anyone, a caregiver? Now, these have all been discovered, as this has nothing to do with the clinical care that's going on. I have example after example after example of this. And the reason I bring this up related to your question is because we look for entrepreneurs, for innovators who have really defined a way in which to find a cohort of patients. So it could be pregnant Medicaid moms, because you have to get that specific. And they have identified, you know, if they apply a certain clinical process consistently to that population, they will get a consistently good outcome, quality outcome, and they can do it in a sustainable at a sustainable price. The biggest problem that this industry has is I call it a cottage industry. I've been technically told that's not really what it is, but
20% of the economy.
Yeah, but
it's still cottage.
Yes, but still very individual practitioners. You know, so the question is, how do you take that once it's learned and consistently apply it over large groups? And so this is what we've done at Oak. So some people think about people who are in PE or venture as people who roll up old mm-hmm. things. We really are all about the reinvention of new services to help support where there are gaps. I can talk on and on. It's like being asked to talk about my daughter. You know, I'm happy to talk about any of my companies, but we've done it. And I give a couple just bullets. One would be in the kidney care area, we didn't want to invest in putting more people in dialysis chairs. We wanted to invest in keeping people out of dialysis chairs, which meant going into kidney care earlier in the identification of patients who needed care, with the goal of not having them crash into dialysis, but having them either avoid it altogether or have home dialysis. So these are the kinds of things, and we find these brilliant people who have discovered, you know, the process to apply to do that.
Bringing us to today, with everything going on, what are your current investment hypotheses and theses, and what does that mean for the kinds of things you're looking to invest in?
We've got about 94 or so active investments. I mostly work on tech-enabled services. So we are still absolutely strong believers in the details count in healthcare. When I work with my companies and we're trying to, let's say, affect change in a population, we will see that there's one part that we've done a really good job with and one part we haven't, and you have to dig into the details as to why that other didn't work. It could be something around ethnicity or access or, you know, the clinics that they're going to, and, you know, you have to get down into those details. And then our hope is that these new methodologies are adopted by employers. I have a wonderful GI company called Oshi. Anyone you know who has GI issues, someone said to me recently, getting a GI appointment in New York City is like winning the lottery. And I'm like, yeah, it should not be that. But GI has evolved from not just being scoping, but also chronic condition management that takes, you know, these teams of people that are nutritionists and mental health providers. And so we create companies to overlay to the existing systems so that we can fix the access problem, we can fix the, you know, inappropriate care problem, and work collaboratively with the doctors that are currently there. care. So we continue this. I mean, we also invest in other things, pharma services. So there are things like when you look at all the infusible drugs that are coming out, you know, there are some things in the world that will get in the way of people being able to get those drugs, like filling the vials and having infusion centers. We look at all of those, you know, process points and look for any choke points and we'll invest in that, as well as just some pure technology that we think is going to make a really big difference.
One of the things I think is really inspiring about your investments is the tech-enabled services, understanding you can't just take the technology and pull it to the side in healthcare. You really need to integrate it with meaningful care delivery. At the same time, I've seen a lot of founders and a lot of companies fail in underestimating the effort and time to get people to change their workflows. You can't really achieve greater quality with less cost without changing workflows. But if the new thing is demanding that, that's a very long process. And so I'm just curious what you've seen work around bringing tech-enabled services into the health ecosystem and making the right bets on what could and would change.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's been an interesting one because there's a lot of great delivery systems here at this conference. So I've been meeting with folks and, you know, I don't want to say this inappropriately, but we're not in the business of trying to get, you know, Mass General Brigham, I'm a Boston person, so I'll use my friends, to change their behaviors. What we're trying to do is go in and really understand how to support, you know, if you want to have your heart transplant or you want it, like they have the best clinicians along with many other cities that we all live in. But there's a whole subset of the population that they're not really taking care of. Great example would be Maven Clinic. For people who don't understand women's health, I mean, a lot of people don't because why would they? Having run most of these practices myself, OBGYNs are surgeons. They really don't have the time to do kind of the overlay support around infertility, fertility, maternity. You know, they really react well to a crisis. We represent these areas to say, what gets in the way of the intention of that doctor? Like, why does a person end up with preeclampsia? Or why does a person end up being pregnant with triplets from infertility? What are the unintended consequences and what can we do to support it? So not do it different than the physicians or providers want it, but how do we support it? In the case of Maven, it's an overlay. It's like having your own, I hate to use the words concierge, but having your own clinicians that you can access 7x24 to help advise you when you can't get the answers that you want or support groups or information. So that is exactly what we're doing. So we're not walking into these health systems and saying we'd like to retrain your OBGYNs at all. We're saying, you know what, we can pick up the slack. You know, when you're seeing a patient and they're like, can we chat about menopause for a while? You know, and you've got six patients waiting to see you. It's not that they don't care. It's that they don't have the time or even the training. So we have found that most of these specialists, it's true for GI, it's true for kidney care, they so appreciate these companies being an overlay to what they do and then making sure that they really work, you know, as efficiently as they can as physicians and that we have other people surrounding the patients to get to the outcomes we need.
One of the things I loved in reading your history and some of the things you've said about who you invest in is this idea of investing in founders that really understand the policy environment.
Yeah. Yes.
And clearly there's a lot there right now.
Yeah.
There are things that are really interesting. There are also a lot of cuts going on, a lot of potential disruption in Medicaid and the ACA space, NIH-funded things. And so I'm curious if you imagine one of your really policy-savvy founders who know how to use policy to create opportunity and to build a moat, what are their moves right now? How are they looking at the current environment?
You know, I think there are many, many times when we would watch the cycles and we would understand them and we would understand a natural delay of a new reg and, you know, be prepared for that. And now it's a little less clear, right? Mm. But the way that I think about it is our companies just need to continue to add value. So these are not nice to have, meaning people might look at a women's health company and be like, oh, it's good you support your women. I want to make sure that not only we support our women, but the CFOs of these employers or these payers will be like, this is important. Because of the money spent and the outcomes and all the rest of it, that they would fight for this because this is a good way to provide healthcare. And we do a lot in the Medicaid space, a lot in the MA space. And so what we're constantly doing is just saying, here's a population, what are you trying to achieve? Managed Medicaid is one of the best things, in my opinion, that ever happened because it allowed all of us to build businesses around supporting Medicaid, which is really, really hard. And to have someone who, you know, cared and was watching it. And competition, there's competition to get those contracts. So our companies end up in those contracts as an offering of look how innovative we are, what a contemporary view we have of taking care of these moms or taking care of these kids or taking care of whomever it is. We keep going and then we keep watching. And it's become, particularly around Medicaid, it's become a state-by-state discussion. I love the details of healthcare and I hate the details of healthcare. But the details are, you know, the states sometimes don't understand what their intermediaries are doing. And so we have to make sure that we are in the world of talking to governors, you know, and helping them understand that if they're excited that their opioid rates have gone down, their death rates have gone down, that they can correlate it to actually a program that was put in place by one of my companies, because somebody else may be trying to cut a rate or trying to do something else.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard because I think there's a real possibility of massive Medicaid cuts,
yes,
but they'll happen over time. Like if we go forward with the provider taxes and the health plan taxes, those will be massive cuts in Medicaid budgets, but it may happen in 2 years. I've, through this podcast, tried to lay out opportunity spaces for Medicaid entrepreneurs in particular. And for those who've been successful and have come on the show, they have said this is not for the faint of heart because you don't have a single decision maker as you do with, well, with Medicare, you still have the MA plans, but with Medicaid, you have the state decision making and then you have the health plan. This, I do feel and worry, is going to create even more of a shadow over that market for potential founders. So I'm trying to think about what encouragement can be offered because it's a huge market.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and people are now talking about these cuts, these potential cuts. You don't know, and I've got some insights, no special insights, but just some people have shared with me what's going on the state level. And there's some states where absolutely we're going to fill the gap. Like, we're going to fill the gap. We are not going to allow this to happen. But then you have this whole domino of, like, they're taking it from something else that could also be something. You know, so it's been, so watching it has been interesting. But we live through the redetermination, you know, so, and, you know, what I'd like to say about that, I mean, there's days I wake up like, I'm going to do a, you know, an op-ed piece as though someone's going to read it and it's going to make a difference. But my companies had to continue to see patients that came off the Medicaid ranks because that's the way we do business, is we continue to provide care. We don't say, oh, gosh, your reimbursement disappeared, so you're halfway through treatment and we're not going to continue. These are our companies. And this is our CEO saying this and us supporting that. That's what we do. And then a lot of them came back on the ranks, and there was no such thing as a retro ad, like where you'd go back and get reimbursed for the time that they were clearly still Medicaid, but just in this administrative limbo. And there's times I want to talk about the impact it has on these companies and that real people are getting affected. So we don't sit on the sidelines and just let it happen. We do our best to educate mostly mm-hmm. people to say, if that happens, this patient won't be treated. They're going to end up hospitalized. You know, it's going to cost you more or whatever the case may be. And then in some cases, getting them onto ACA or getting them onto other platforms, it's been a roller coaster.
Yeah. As some people have said, this is full employment for consulting companies. Because the other thing is a lot of state systems are going to have to be built depending on, again, what happens.
Yeah.
There's been an emerging conversation among folks at the intersection of sort of philanthropy and investment around we need innovation across so many domains of health. Venture is the right pathway for some. And for many others, it's a mismatch, either because they need a longer time horizon, because it will never be a big exit, even if it creates a lot of value. Yeah. And so the conversation has turned to what would an alternative model look like? How could funding sources from philanthropy and venture and private equity be merged together? And I'm just curious how you think about those questions in that space.
I'm smiling because I think a lot about it, and I'm not known to be shy, so I talk a lot about it. I've heard a lot of this on the stages here at Aspen Health on both sides. And the both sides are, you know, we should really get more philanthropy in here to cover, you know, supporting caregivers. And that just seems inherently exhausting to me. Like, that seems like an ongoing, it's just not sustainable. Like, you just have to keep, you have to renew and renew and renew. If the original money comes to create a, you know, sustainable model, then that's amazing. And I met with a couple of people sitting inside of health systems coming up with these incredible models. And I'm like, you know, I'm happy to, I'll consult for, you know, just for the sake of it, to tell you how to create a commercial model around this. How do you show that supporting the mental health of family caregivers, you know, doing that lowers costs for Anthem? Like, that's what you have to do. And once you do that, you know, once you do that in a really meaningful way, then people will trip over themselves to get more of this capability built. But just like, shouldn't we do this, is not, doesn't get it done efficiently, doesn't scale.
I would just maybe push a little bit to say, I do think there are problems where the venture assumptions don't work. And even if it's a viable thing that needs to be solved, it is not going to be solved in that manner. Maybe even how do you think about what are those spaces? What do those spaces look like? Or what are the characteristics where it's not the right approach?
So I sit on various innovation committees in Boston on Children's Hospital and McLean's other things. And once in a while, there's like an incredible idea. And it probably would take someone's teenager to code an app. You know, you're just like, this just should just be done. Right. Like some of these things are just in the category of like, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. You're still handing out recipes, you know, on a piece of paper to people who have to calculate calories and intake. So there's that. And then there are some things like, I'll give you an example that is just so difficult, is Medicaid maternity, because it is a very, very complex set of issues, very, very expensive to deliver care. And most of the, if you will, ROI, the claims-based savings are associated with the baby and keeping the baby from the NICU. This is generational. If you fix this, you fix it generationally. Like there's, I just can't think of anything that's much more important. But there is no reimbursement model that, and people who are the best people who are doing this in inner cities right now, caregivers are like, oh my gosh, Nancy, you can't go and try to build a company, a venture-backed company on this. It will not survive. Then I go to the payers and say, can't we combine? Can't we just, like, this doesn't seem like it needs like multiple equations to figure this out, you know?
You're not going to differentiate on this.
Yes. Right? And so why can't we create this bundle that is a mommy-baby bundle? And so that we can then innovate and get, you know, get these processes in place to take care of these moms that will have generational benefits. And so there's things like that, which we just can't create a sustainable model, you know, behind it. Beyond the passion and the mission is math. And it's not all that complicated, meaning you've got to be able to deliver a service that gets to an outcome someone cares about. And you have to be able to get paid slightly more than what you deliver it for, so you can have, you know, a margin on it.
Yeah.
And now with things like AI, which we focus very much on, a lot of the dollars spent are administrative, like just work. And so it's very exciting to think about how to take out a lot of the work, like intake of a patient and filling out forms and going through medical records. And so these kinds of things, I feel like I've lived long enough that maybe that'll
we'll
give us another.
We'll actually get them.
We can finally
do prior auth.
Oh my God, we need a whole other podcast and maybe a bottle of wine
exactly.
to talk about prior auth. Yes.
I was talking to a health plan and they were so excited about launching their new prior auth platform. And I was like, I think I remember that you did this 2 years ago and it was a different company.
Yes.
So
no.
I don't want to get too cynical.
Yes.
But,
and I won't tell you what year I first started thinking about prior auth.
Yeah, exactly. Still needs to be fixed. Two final questions. One is, I work with a lot of public health students.
Yeah.
And Berkeley is renowned for graduating the most graduates who end up founding venture-backed startups. Very few of them have training in public health. And very few of the Berkeley students that go on to become founders focus on health at all. And so one of the questions I've been asking in my role at the School of Public Health is, how do we actually ignite curiosity from public health students about what that pathway could look like? And what does that mean they should be doing while they're students? What skills should they be building? What moves should they make when they graduate? A lot of the public health students, like you've described before, they could say, I know what the problem is, the public health problem. I have no idea how to create a business around it. So what advice would you give our amazing public health students? Because I think they would be tremendous founders, but for them, it's kind of a black box. So what skills should they learn? What moves should they make?
I love this topic. And I work on the advisory committee to the board or to the dean at Northeastern. Zeke Emanuel worked with us and he's at Penn. And, you know, so and I know other Berkeley people. And I keep complaining, honestly, about some of the business graduates because they, you know, there's a lot of clinicians that go through business school at these very prestigious places. And they come out, in my opinion, and this is a broad, you know, generalization with mosaic dot knowledge. Like I know I learned this, this, and this, but they don't know how to bring it together. Most of the things that that I'm doing these things, these areas that I talked about, the fundamental learning about these came from public health. These are all like, so this is exactly the group who, if you have the let's just call it the scientific knowledge, the data knowledge, the ability to understand this, and you can articulate like the approach, then you can, you know, you can work with people who are process people, business people, and think about how do you achieve this goal? Like, how do you do this? And we've seen this, like I get very attracted to, you know, Lena Wen, who was in Baltimore. She did amazing things in the Medicaid population with women. And I tend to go to people like that. And I'm like, what was the program? What did you do? How did you apply it?
Right.
Like, how can I take this and commercialize it and scale it across a lot
that.
Of states? Because it's those very people that you're describing sitting in your school and other schools who know exactly. It's the subset of the pot. You know, they know the details, because in the public health world, it's the details of, oh, wait, why is the, you know, Hispanic population not getting mammograms at the rate? Oh, because they need to come in with their spouses, and or we don't have translators, or whatever it is. And then we can figure out how to commercialize it and scale
it. It's good timing because Sean Duffy would say that Omada was founded on a study that showed a certain model would work for diabetes. And then he imagined a company that could deliver that. So I love that.
You know, my chief medical officers at some of my companies are the most extraordinary people in their fields. And so people are like, they're working for a venture. They left, you know, working, you know, with Atul Gawande or whomever to come to a venture-backed company. And I'm like, it's a testament to their belief that this is how we're going to scale their ideas. This is how we're going to do more for maternal health.
Yes.
You know, than the way that it's been approached otherwise. And that makes me very happy that we're able to do that.
I love that. My final question.
Yes.
I've been asking everybody here. It has a different maybe angle for you as an investor. But if you were to launch, no strings attached, a moonshot idea to reimagine how we create health in the U.S., what would it be?
A moonshot idea.
This is a Todd Park question.
Yeah, it is a Todd Park question. Well, I'm stuttering because there's no silver bullet like idea, you know, but I will always go back. And I think Todd would too. Always go back to the staff model, like full alignment. What we've done is we had this full alignment and we had beautiful outcomes when we are fully aligning who's paying for it. Not just the smattering of a little quality measures here and there, but who's paying for it and the alignment of all the processes associated with that population. Now, the problem with that model is consumers rejected it. They didn't reject it based, in my opinion, based on fact, which was that we got the highest quality scores of anyone in any health plan in the U.S. They rejected it because they wanted to go to the person their friends mentioned at Mass General, you know, not realizing that we had curated our doctors. They weren't like leftover doctors. These were like phenomenal doctors who had these points of view. So I don't know if this is a moonshot or I need to get the mentalists that they had here earlier, you know, to come and brainwash everyone. But we need to get back to that.
We had a model that worked.
Yes.
How could we go back to that?
And it was the reason it did not continue, in my opinion, and most of my friends who we have healthy debate will agree to this, is that because consumers rejected it because they didn't have ultimate choice. And there was an assumption that without choice was then quality was missing. And then we've dabbled around the edges of trying to make people accountable for care and having value-based care. And there's a whole nother podcast as to why you can't dabble around the edges.
No.
You just can't.
And it's interesting, having grown up in Boston and now living in California, I would not say that's true for Kaiser Permanente, at least in the California context. And I think they're interesting questions, maybe they haven't grown the way we've seen other things grown, but people really do take it as their assumed pathway. And now Boston's very unique in having such a medical tertiary, you know, do you want to go to BI or Brigham Women's or Mass General for your surgery? I mean, it's just like overwhelming
right.
in that way, in a way that I don't think the Bay is, but there is a different mentality there.
And I'll hear, you know, people who maybe they're just trying to, you know, suck up to me, but when they come and pitch and they'll be like, we're going to do a virtual Kaiser. I'm like, yes. And that means that you have a point of view about every bit of care that's being delivered. And you have a point of view about the benefit package.
Mm.
And you have a point of view about what you'll spend money on and what you won't. And by the way, if you discover tonight something that will help a part of your population, you don't have to go get approval from some from 17 different insurers. You can just put it in place. And we have example after example after
example. I'll be looking for that in your investment
portfolio. I'm bringing it back. I'm bringing it back. Yes, exactly.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for coming on.
So much fun.
As an investor in tech-enabled solutions, Nancy is very clear. Founders cannot expect big delivery systems to change what they do, but they can work around them to create an overlay that makes healthcare more effective and efficient. And that makes a lot of sense. If every innovation required a massive system shift, we'd never get anything done. On the other hand, if we only innovate in the cracks and crevices, how much real change can we actually expect to see? That's why Nancy's bold idea to make a big bet on what she calls Kaiser for everyone is so intriguing. Kaiser has its own challenges with innovation, for sure, but they have one elephant-sized advantage. The incentives for health and improvement are lined up. Does it sound feasible? Not really. But it may be one of the only ways we can push innovation to the middle, not just get it at the edges. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Nancy Brown. There's more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.